You are listening to RudolfSteinerAudio.com. If you are listening to the podcast of this, it is located at RudolfSteiner.podbean.com. Please consider becoming a patron. As well, there are two publishing houses, SteinerBooks.org in America and RudolfSteinerPress.com in England, who are the sole publishers of Steiner into English and have given me permission to do these recordings. Please consider patronizing them as well. This is a reading of Collected Works, Volume 189 by Rudolf Steiner, entitled Conscious Society, Anthroposophy and the Social Question, 8 lectures translated by Matthew Barton. This is Lecture 2, given in Dornach on the 16th of February, 1919. I keep reiterating, and did so again yesterday in connection with our appeal, that my priority in the life and context of modern humanity is to elicit true social understanding in as many people as possible. It must not be forgotten that the conditions that have developed in recent times have brought a kind of chaos over a large swath of the civilized world, and that the only remedy for this chaos will arise within human souls themselves. External measures, whether these are conceived as legislature or as merely external organization of economic life, will not prove capable of properly and comprehensively aiding humanity in the situation that has now arisen. In some lands, certainly, things can continue as they are for a while. But it would be mistaken to believe that faced with the social inundation inevitably swelling now and threatening to overwhelm all humanity, isolated countries can preserve their status quo in the long term. No aid can come other than from social understanding and insight, from ideas developing within human souls about social conditions. What I have now said in a somewhat complex fashion can also be said more simply. What is driven into disorder will not come back into order unless people show themselves able to create order. And they will only do so if they acquire real social understanding, something that humanity today and people of all political persuasions are very far removed from indeed. The first thing to be considered is how to spread this social understanding. Here it is of overwhelming importance that what lives in the souls of millions and millions of proletarian workers is at odds with what lives in the ruling classes. The governing classes bear within them, very largely, the legacy of a gentrified outlook, and seek to apply this now, albeit in somewhat campaigning fashion, to the conditions in which the workers live. This is a drastic reality, one we only take proper account of by resolving, firstly, to disseminate social understanding. Even if it is clear that outward conditions are likely to become still more confused than they already are, it would be mistaken to think that anything will be gained by patching them up at critical places. What is generally lacking today is social insight, and it is lacking because the whole development of thinking, of feeling and will too, in modern times, has been alien to the development of social understanding. Even those who carry a powerful social impulse today have extraordinarily little social insight. But please do not imagine that social insight depends on some esoteric, wide-ranging, comprehensive knowledge. Rather, the most elementary social orientation is lacking in people today. People think in terms quite other than those needed to acquire the most primitive social understanding, which is all that is required to start with. The right course, above all, is to seek a path that leads away from the abstract, fantasist ideas that many today so comfortably adopt. People believe that it is possible today to solve the social problem from some ethical or religious perspective. But this is not so. Preaching ethical and religious sermons warms the heart and has some, especially egoistic, effect. But what is actually needed is to render our ideas capable of intervening in the fabric of society itself. So much depends today, therefore, on acquiring social insight. I said that even those who bear a powerful social impulse often have primitive ideas. There are many people, aren't there, belonging both to the ruling classes and to the working classes, who think that a simple reordering of the classes can bring about real change. For example, if those who have been dominant, ministers and secretaries of state, are demoted, while others previously in lower working class positions rise to the top. It would be completely mistaken to think this. Many may deny that they harbor such ideas, and yet they do. They are befuddled by all kinds of partisan views and so are unaware that this is what they really think. What is needed is quite simple. People need to develop understanding of what I have often presented, both here and in public lectures. Understanding of the necessary threefolding of the social organism. All aspects of social measures need to be undertaken in a way that takes account of the necessity implicit in this threefolding. That's the important thing. Whether such measures relate to, say, building a railway that is to be assigned either to a private company or to the state, or whether it is a matter of remuneration for work accomplished, and I especially do not say remuneration for an employee, in all these matters, the measures taken should accord with this threefolding principle, in line with the independence of, respectively, spiritual life, the life of rights, the state, political life per se, and economic life. People may well ask how one thing or another should be done, but mostly such questions are mistaken at the stage in which we now are with these matters. The spirit of what lives in this threefolding movement can be described roughly as follows. To take just one instance, let's consider the taxation system. At present, it is not a matter at all of conceiving the best possible taxation system, but instead of working toward threefolding. And as this is increasingly realized, the best tax system will naturally develop via the action of this threefold social organism. We have to create the conditions under which the best social institutions can emerge. It is no good for someone to sit down and fabricate the, quote, best system, close quote, for this will have no value in reality. Even if you were the greatest genius who ever lived and could conceptually elaborate the best taxation system possible, it will serve no purpose if others reject it. Maybe what they want is wrong, but they do not want what you propose. That is the important thing. So it isn't a matter of conceiving the best system, but of discovering what can form the soundest basis on which all humanity will do the best it can. And then you might say, yes, but one has to start somewhere. One has to establish threefolding even if people don't wish it. But here we are in a different realm, not one where people either wish or don't wish a particular tax system. Here we are concerned with something that basically all people desire once they understand it. If you find the right way to do so, this is something you really can get people to understand. For, subconsciously, human beings desire its realization throughout the civilized world in the next few decades. This is not something theoretical, but an observation of what human beings intend. Numerous people reject it at present, not because they do not want it, but only because they are full of preconceptions and are still really working counter to something that seeks realization. We have to focus on the thing of underlying primary importance. Understanding can awaken for the primary thing here, however long it takes, if some of what impedes understanding is removed. Naturally, some of the ruling classes still stand in the way of this. It will be impossible to persuade them, and they will never come round until they get a bloody nose from all the resistance they encounter. There will be a great deal of such resistance. And that is why, if we do not at first succeed in the way we imagine, we should not give up on this approach and think it in vain. Preparation is needed for this outlook, which must be waiting in the wings when what is at present, mistakenly, being realized in the world has led to absurd extremes. And when much of what is figuring in the world has gone, like, say, the German princes who in 1913 never dreamed that they would be gone by 1919. When everything that people still praise to the skies has vanished, something at least must remain in their hearts and minds which they can resort to. This must be prepared. The ground must be laid. This is the view you should hold to, my dear friends. Once you have delved deep enough and for long enough into this three-folding of spiritual life, political life, and economic life, you will experience a need to develop further understanding of these matters. It is this understanding that is so much needed. Otherwise, people talk about everything with the best will in the world, but no reality can ensue from it. The social organism is subject to certain laws in exactly the same way as the natural human organism. If, however fine your principles, you act counter to these laws of the social organism, you will achieve nothing. At most, you will lead people down a cul-de-sac. This is the important thing. Do not imagine it contradicts human freedom to be placed into the fabric of a social organism with particular laws. This is not a sensible thought. We might equally well ask whether we are free because we are compelled to eat every day. Eating or not is not part of our freedom. The things in the world that are subject to a certain lawfulness in which we are embedded have not the least to do with the problem of freedom, any more than our inability to reach up and pluck the moon down to earth has anything to do with our freedom. Something else is connected with the social understanding that we need, our capacity to delve back into fundamental, primary matters and not hang our social insight upon secondary or tertiary things, which are only an after-effect. Of course, in certain respects, we can say that we need a minimum value to subsist. And let us directly translate value into monetary terms here. We need a certain income to survive. In certain respects, we can speak of a minimum livelihood. But in speaking of this minimum livelihood, we can be referring, on the one hand, to something completely self-evident, and yet on the other to something that is utter nonsense. Let me try to illustrate what I mean with an example. If you study conditions in a particular region, a basic feeling, an instinctive feeling, can perhaps tell you that someone who does simple manual labor requires so and so much as minimum livelihood. Otherwise, he cannot live in his community. This may seem a self-evident thought. But ask yourself now, if it is equally self-evident, when in the terms I have stated, this is unrealizable within the social organism within which someone lives. If this simply can't be realized, what then? This is the question that must be addressed first and foremost. What happens when it is impossible for this to be realized? Matters, as I just described them, are not a primary thought. People do not go back to fundamentals, but start from secondary things, mere after-effects of others. To gain social understanding, we must always seek to return to first things. One fundamental thing here is to be able to form a view, a life-enhancing view, of how the minimum livelihood can arise in accordance with the living, determining realities of the social organism. By life-enhancing, I mean, in this case, a view or outlook from which tenable social conditions and a tenable social community of people can ensue. That is the primary thing, but now we arrive at certain ideas that modern humanity may often find very uncomfortable, since in the last few centuries, education has failed to address them or direct people's attention to them in a meaningful way. It is high time that people realized that to be halfway educated involves more than knowing that 3 times 9 is 27. It is equally important to understand the meaning of a term such as, in quotes, ground rent. Let me ask you this. How many people today have a clear idea what this means? And yet without seeing how such things form part of the social organism, it simply won't be possible for humanity to prosper in future. These things have gradually become very confused. And this confusion has led to people formulating ideas that do not reflect actual conditions in this realm. You see, the ground rent that can be evaluated according to the productivity of a certain piece of land gives rise, let us say, to a particular sum for a state-defined region. Land is worth so and so much according to its productivity, or in other words, according to the manner or degree of its rational exploitation in relation to the overall economy. For people today, it is very difficult to think of this simple land value in clear terms, because in a modern economy, capital interest, or capital in general, has become confused with ground rent. This is because the real economic value of ground rent has been falsified by mortgage law, bonds, and stocks trading, and such like. In consequence, everything has basically been distorted by impossible, untrue ideas. Naturally, we can't therefore suddenly gain a real idea of ground rent. But we should think of ground rent simply as the economic value of the land itself in any region in relation to its productivity. Now there is a necessary relationship between this ground rent and what I stated before about a person's minimum livelihood. As you know, there are various social reformers and social revolutionaries nowadays who dream of the abolition of ground rent altogether, who believe, for instance, that ground rent will be abolished if ownership of all land is seized by the state or by society. But simply giving something a different form does not abolish it. Whether the whole municipality owns the land and estate, or whether it is owned by a certain number of people, does not affect that fact that a ground rent exists. It only masks the fact, assuming different forms. Defined, as I defined it earlier, ground rent always exists. If you look at the ground rent for a particular region, you divide it by the number of its inhabitants and arrive at a quotient, which in turn gives rise to the only possible minimum livelihood. This is an immutable law, something like, say, the Boyle-Marriott law in physics. And it is a primary reality, a fundamental fact, that no one really should earn more in any social organism than the sum of the whole ground rent divided by the number of inhabitants. Anything earned over and above this is earned by cooperatives and associations, thus creating conditions whereby greater values accrue to one person than to another. But in reality, an individual cannot come into possession of unfixed assets worth more than I just described. And this minimum, which exists everywhere in reality, even if actual conditions hide this fact, gives rise to all economic life, insofar as this economic life relates to one's unfixed assets as an individual. We have to start from this fundamental fact. That is the important thing, to start from a primary and not a secondary level. You can compare this primary fact with any other of a primary nature, say with the basic fact applicable to economic life, that any particular region has a certain quantity of raw materials. Of course, you might wish this region to have more in the way of this raw product. You could work out the increased benefit you would have from the region if this were so. But you can't increase its raw resources, and that is a primary reality. It is likewise a primary fact that in reality, no one in a social organism earns more. You see, you don't earn through labor, however much you work. Then this quotient I cited. Let me read that sentence again. It is likewise a primary fact that in reality no one in a social organism earns more. You see, you don't earn through labor, however much you work. Then this quotient I cited. Everything over and above that amount is effected amongst people by associations and so forth. Now, political institutions can act counter to such a reality, can violate it. Therefore, what needs to happen is that our thinking should come to accord with realities. That is the vital thing. Happiness amongst humankind can only arise through insight into these things. If we bring our organizing, reality-creating thinking into line with tendencies required by the very nature of the social organism, then everything else follows by itself. And then no one can feel at a disadvantage compared to another. This is a law that underlies the actual life and reality of the social organism. And you can only think about such things in the right way, only gain concepts that have a purchase on reality. I gave you the example of the relation between minimum livelihood and the ground rent. If you base them on threefolding, as the founding principle. You see, only by the influence of this threefolding will people become able to shape human community so that in any particular region it develops in the most productive way. Life will develop most productively if it tends toward lawfulness and accords with it, rather than acting counter to it. So the important thing is to live in tune with the nature of the social organism. But now we must clarify the following. You will not derive insight into the fundamental nature of threefolding from an external observation of life, just as little as you could derive the theorem of Pythagoras by simply looking at right-angled triangles, however many of them you looked at. But once you have this law, it can be applied universally to all right-angled triangles. This is the nature of fundamental laws. They are universally applicable once you have grasped them in the right way, in their actual relationship to reality. And you, my dear friends, also have an opportunity to grasp the need for this threefolding out of the foundations of spiritual science. Similarly, you can understand that this threefolding encompasses, firstly, what I will call the life of earthly spirituality, art, science, religion, and, as I have said, private and criminal law, too. That is one sphere. The second sphere is the political society and community of human beings, and applies to the relationship between one person and another. The third sphere is economic life, governing the relationship between the human being and what is, in a sense, inhuman, what we need so that we can raise ourselves to our true humanity. These three spheres are meant when we speak of threefolding, and in accordance with which we must seek to be members of the social organism. This is how we must engage in the social organism, for all three spheres originate in a quite different aspect of human nature itself. All earthly life of spirit and culture is, in a sense, the echo, and what I say here applies to our epoch, of what we have experienced in the life before we descended to birth, to physical existence. Then we lived as a human spiritual individuality, in a spiritual connection with the higher hierarchies, in spiritual connection with the disembodied souls living at present in the world of spirit, and not at that moment embodied on earth. The cultural and spiritual life we develop here on earth, whether this be through religious activity or practice, in religious community, or through artistic activity, or through acting as a judge, giving a verdict on someone who has in some way violated the law, or done an injustice to another person, all originates from powers which we acquired in community existence in the world of spirit before we descended into earth physical existence through birth. Here you must distinguish between community with other human beings, in accordance with individual destiny, and community with others, as I just characterized it. In earthly existence, we form individual relationships with people, dependent on our individual karma. And these either draw from past lives on earth, or point toward future lives. These individual, interpersonal relationships must be distinguished from others, those into which you enter by belonging, say, to a particular religious community. Here you will feel an identity in common with a number of others within this community. Or let us imagine that a book is published. Those who read it and absorb the same thoughts from it also form a community. Earthly cultural life, whether it relates to education or other fields, involves forming relationships with others, forming communities so that we advance spiritually through them. And all this is the expression of relationships we had, in a quite different form, before we descended into earthly culture. It has nothing to do with individual karma, but with what was prepared in the period we experienced in the world of spirit between death and rebirth. And so we must seek the source and origin of what I have specifically called the spiritual sphere in the life we underwent before embarking on our descent into physical existence at birth. And then, there is something we undergo and experience simply by living here on earth from birth to death. We only gradually grow into this life. Entering physical existence at birth, we still bear round us the eggshells of the world of spirit, though shells is wrong, since it suggests something much harder than I mean. The child is very spiritual, despite the fact that his major task is to develop the physical body. But he has much spirituality in his aura, and what he brings with him has a great affinity with the nature of earthly, spiritual, and cultural life. But gradually we enter more and more into the life that belongs only to the time between birth and death. In this life here, which, as such, bears no relation to anything in the realm of spirit, lie the sources of the life of the political state. The political state is only connected with what we undergo and experience between birth and death, and therefore only what concerns the relationship between one person and another, as people living in this life on earth, should mingle with the political life of the state. If anything else gets mixed up with this, if, for instance, the state spreads its pinions over cultural or spiritual life, over church and education, over anything other than the public life of rights between birth and death, we can say that the prince of this world holds sway where he should not. Anything governed by state organization should be informed only by what relates to this life between birth and death. The third sphere is the one I described as economic. This economic life, which we are obliged to conduct as people who have to eat and drink, who have to dress ourselves in clothes, and so on, compels us to delve down into the subhuman realm. This chains us to something intrinsically lower than the level of our full humanity. Having to preoccupy ourselves with economic life, we manifest something which, from a social perspective, contains more within it than we usually think. Engaged with and participating in economic life, we cannot live according to the Spirit, or even according to law and justice. But we have to submerge ourselves in something subhuman. Yet, precisely by doing so, something develops within us that can only develop in this way. As we organize our economic life, as we participate actively in economic life, and higher thoughts fall silent, and even interpersonal relationships only play in from their different sphere, something works itself out in our subconscious, which we then bear with us into the world of spirit after passing through the gate of death. Whereas in the life of culture and spirit on earth, we express the echo of what we experienced spiritually before we descended to earth, and whereas in the life of rights in the political domain, we only express what belongs to the time between birth and death, when we participate in economic life, into which we cannot bring down our higher being, something prepares itself in us, which is also spiritual, and which we bear with us through the portal of death. However much people might like economic life to be an earthly matter alone, it is not. But precisely because we submerge ourselves in the economic life, something is prepared for us as human beings, which in turn has a relationship with the supersensible world. And therefore no one should regard the organizing of economic life as being of small importance. This outward material life precisely has a certain relationship with the life after death, however strange and paradoxical this may sound. And so for those who have insight into human nature, the three spheres diverge. The purely spiritual sphere points back to pre-birth life. The sphere of politics and the state points to life between birth and death. And economic life points forward to life after death. It is truly not for nothing that we develop fraternity in economic life. In all fraternity that develops on the foundation of economic life lie the antecedents, the preconditions, for the life we develop after death. I am only giving you a brief outline here, and later we will look into these things in greater depth, of how the threefold membering of human nature sheds light in this respect, precisely for the spiritual scientist, on how the life of society necessarily divides into three different spheres. That is the distinctive thing about spiritual science. If we engage fully with it, it leads to directly practical outcomes. It illumines the life around us. And today people can illumine the real circumstances and conditions of life only if they engage in some way or other with spiritual science. And so it would be desirable if those who interest themselves in the spiritual science movement would disseminate understanding to the others. You see, it is easier, relatively speaking, for the spiritual scientist to understand these matters. He knows of such things as life both before and after death from the perspective of spiritual science, and he can recognize the need for threefolding from this perspective. It is possible in our day already to recognize the need for threefolding. But a more thorough and comprehensive insight into this is gained when we also have the spiritual scientific foundations, which I have now been speaking of. In recent centuries, you see, much pie in the sky has been spoken about general morality and such like, sundered from external daily life by the greatest conceivable gulf. We are now in an era when we must form concepts capable of descending into daily life that go beyond vague promises of redemption and the need to love one another. People don't love one another because they ought to. The ideas we form in these domains have to have the impetus and traction to really illumine an economic life that has grown so complex. The need for threefolding of the healthy social organism is given simply through insight into human nature. As many people as possible should recognize this to be the primary, underlying foundation for renewal. Mere talk of the spirit, which I spoke of yesterday, may even be more harmful today than the materialism that started in the mid-19th century and has gone on spreading to this day. Merely talking of the spirit, you see, merely yearning for it or invoking it, is no longer fitting for our time. What is needed in our time is to realize the spirit, to give it the possibility of living amongst us. It is not sufficient nowadays for people to believe in Christ. We have to realize the Christ in our actions, our work, our conduct. That is the important thing. If people can develop healthy thinking and feeling in this realm and in this respect, their thinking and feeling will also flow into something else. Please never forget the following. A great majority of the officiating representatives of one or another Christian confession speak of Christ. I have mentioned this here in the past from other perspectives. And it is important to keep illuminating these things from a range of different standpoints. People speak of Christ. But if you ask them why the Christ they speak of warrants this name, they can only offer an apparent answer, and in fact are caught up in an inner lie. A great number of modern theologians speak of Christ, but since the Gospels have gradually more or less been mauled to pieces by supposed researchers, they would be unable to reply if you asked them how the Christ being, as they conceive him, differs from the Yahweh God, from God as such, who indwells the world as its inner essence. The great theologian Harnack in Berlin wrote a book entitled The Nature of Christianity. But his account of the being of Christ is identical with the Yahweh of the Old Testament, and has precisely the same attributes. It is an inner lie to address Yahweh as Christ. And the same is true of hundreds upon hundreds of thousands of those who preach Christianity today. For they only preach God in general, the God of whom one can say ex Deo nascimur. We only find the Christ when we have experienced a kind of inner rebirth. The God we refer to when we say ex Deo nascimur concerns our whole ordinary healthy human constitution. Being an atheist actually means being ill. But we can only speak of Christ if we have experienced a kind of rebirth of the life within, of soul, something that is not simply innate in us by virtue of birth. When we experience a rebirth in our soul that accords with our current cycle of evolution. And we can do so if we recognize that today a person is inevitably burdened with preconceptions from birth. They are innate in us and constitute our being today. And if we stay as we were born, we bear these prejudices with us throughout life. We live in a one-sided way. We can only redeem ourselves today through inner tolerance by being able to engage with the opinions, even if we think them mistaken, of other people. If we have understanding, inmost understanding for the views of other souls, even if we think they are mistaken, and if we can lovingly absorb what the other thinks and feels in the same way as what we ourselves feel and think, we acquire this capacity, this inner tolerance, and then we gradually get beyond the preconceptions and prejudices innate in us at this stage of evolution. Then we learn to say this: what you have understood in the least of my brothers, you have understood of me. For the Christ spoke to people not only at the time when Christianity began, but made true his saying that, quote, I am with you always, even unto the end of the world, close quote. And indeed he does keep revealing himself. It was not only once that he said, quote, inasmuch as ye have done it to the least of these my brethren, ye have done it unto me, close quote. He still says this today. He tells us that, quote, what you understand with inner tolerance in one of the least of my brethren, even if it is mistaken, you have understood of me, and I will enable you to overcome your prejudices if you shed them by absorbing with tolerance what the other thinks and feels. Close quote. That is one thing. In respect of thinking, this is the way to come to Christ, so that Christ enters us, and we not only have thoughts or ideas about him, but that he lives in our thoughts. He will only do so by the means I have just described. The second thing relates to the will. In youth, we may often be idealistic, have an innate idealism. We have this simply by virtue of being born as human beings. This human idealism is no longer enough in our present evolutionary cycle. Today we need another idealism, one we educate ourselves to acquire over and above our natural human endowment, one we discipline ourselves to develop. We need an idealism we ourselves have acquired, and this is an idealism that does not fade with youth, but keeps us young and idealistic throughout life. If we acquire this kind of idealism, then founded on a non-logical, yet reality-attuned law, it gives us the impetus to act not just as egoistic people, but to integrate ourselves with the social organism and to act within it. Unless we undertake or educate ourselves to acquire a self-cultivated idealism, we will never gain real social understanding. We gain the ex Deo nascimur by virtue of being born. the path to Christ, passes, on the one hand, through supersensible thoughts, and on the other, through the will. The path of thought involves a recognition that we are born today with prejudices and preconceptions and must shed these by tolerant engagement with the opinions of others. The path of will involves recognition that this will can only be kindled socially in the right way if we develop self-acquired idealism, an idealism that we have inculcated in ourselves through our own activity. Through this, we are reborn. And what we discover in this way, by acquiring it for ourselves as human beings, leads alone to Christ. We cannot refer to the God of whom we say ex Deo nascimur as Christ, for this is an inner untruth, a God who can also figure in the Old Testament. The God who speaks to us if we transform ourselves during our life in the two ways I have indicated will be felt as one clearly different in nature from the Father God as such, and that is Christ. Modern theology speaks very little of this Christ. This Christ must enter humanity as a social impulse, whereas many today speak of Christ in a way that is nothing but an inner lie. Things such as these cannot dawn on our understanding through merely logical reasoning. Not long ago I said to you that there is an understanding of reality which is different from merely outward logical understanding. But when we develop in ourselves what I here described as rebirth, our thinking comes close to Christ, and we learn to think and feel as we must if we are to integrate ourselves into human society today in a way that serves humanity's salvation. And then also we learn to think and feel about other matters too, in the right way, if we first think rightly about this fundamental thing. Cultural life today has lapsed a long way from this, and the reason is often that the modern political state has overshadowed and infiltrated it. The life of spirit and culture must be emancipated from the life of the political state in order to become fruitful again and give real impetus to human evolution. If not, all thoughts will become distorted, and distorted realities will be created as a result. I once spoke about Wilson's definition of freedom. Of course, how a modern statesman defines freedom does not have much relation to philosophical discourse. But what lives in someone when he articulates this or that idea of freedom is significant as a symptom. Wilson says we call something free that adapts itself to certain conditions so that it can move freely within them. Thus, in a machine, if a basket can move freely along a conveyor belt without being impeded, we can say that the basket moves freely. Or a ship, constructed so that it runs with the wind, moves freely forward. If it were to sail against the wind, it would accordingly be unfree. And in this sense, says Wilson, a human being is likewise free, if he is adapted to conditions within the social mechanism. Less important than the fact such thoughts live in someone's head and are realized is that what is realized expresses itself in such thoughts. We can discern here whether it is healthy or runs counter to health. The idea is a total distortion. And why? You need only draw on the feelings you can gain from spiritual science when reflecting on the following. If you have adapted, and you can be very well adapted to outward circumstances, so that your life runs in accord with them and you never meet an obstacle, you are free in this view, like a ship that sails with the wind. But this is not how we stand in the world. If the ship sails with the wind, it is supposedly free. And yet at some point it has to be able to stop. It is of great importance that we can sometimes change direction, turn about, and sail against the wind, so that we are not only adapted to outer conditions, but can also adapt to our own inner impulses. And it's hard to think of a more foolish and inept definition of freedom than Wilson's, for it contradicts human nature itself. It states the very opposite of what underlies the real nature of human freedom. If we are going to compare the human being with a ship that sails, in quotes, freely with the wind, then we must add that it must also be able to turn around when it needs to and sail against the wind, so that it is not compelled to be driven ever onward. If a person must always be driven on by outer circumstances, he is free only in adhering to these circumstances, but not free for his own purposes. In their modern outlook, people have lost sight entirely of the human being as such. There is nothing left to build on there. The human being has got lost from this modern outlook and needs to be reintegrated into the world. What I have now said has very, very serious aspects. I have outlined it only as a general symptom, but it has grave aspects. The human being's participation in the social organism today can be described as the ship sailing only with the wind. The capitalist system has, in particular, forced the working classes to sail with the wind only, never allowing them to stop, turn about, and sail against it to gain some peace and respite. At the public lecture in Basel, I said that in the capitalist economic order, the capitalist only needs the labor of the worker. In the healthy social organism, on the other hand, the capitalist also requires the respite of the laborer, requires him to need a break. The abstract capital of the capitalist system only needs labor, whereas the capital that is fed back into a purely human momentum will also require the peace and respite of the worker, will require all people to recuperate. This capital must be socially integrated into the social organism in an awareness of how the worker is both sustained by and sustains the social organism. If we think in a healthy way within the spiritual sphere, we know perfectly well what a single individual life is, a matter for itself, not for the social organism. But insofar as we have a life in the community, in society, we draw what we are spiritually from human community and must give it back again, and will experience the need to give it back again. This is vital, that we equally need a worker who is spared from his labors so as to participate in spiritual cultural life, that we have the will to give the worker respite, to spare him from his labors sufficiently to enable him also to participate in the life of spirit. That is the important thing. The gentrified economic order gradually created a gulf, as I suggested yesterday. It created a cultural domain that relates only to this gentrified order and has no connection whatsoever with proletarian life. And additionally, we can say that capitalism ended up requiring only the labor of the workers and not their rest. Today, such things still seem abstract, but they must no longer be so. The wholesome development of our human present and future depends on a proper understanding of these things. Now, I made a few suggestions today about a connection between various fundamental spiritual scientific principles and the life of society. It would be so good if a spiritual movement like ours also became a small, sound, and healthy social organism by acting as a vehicle for practical, living ideas informed by spiritual science. It would be an excellent thing if the gulf sundering economic, material life from spiritual life, this terrible, unhealthy division that has developed and does such harm to humanity, should finally cease. the social organism must structure itself so that a situation can no longer occur where people save up their coupons on the one hand, and in doing so are nothing more than slave owners, since the coupons they cut out depend on a number of people unconnected to them undertaking hard labor. Then they go to church and pray to God to save them, or attend meetings where idealistic theories of all kinds are expounded, with no recognition of what nonsense it is to lead a life of spirit in the abstract, or have a connection with God while at the same time participating in slave ownership by cutting out these coupons, which is tantamount to worker exploitation. If you do not take care to make healthy distinctions, you end up sundering things in an unhealthy way. This is what has been missed and must be remedied, this abstract separation, this creating of a gulf between a cloud cuckoo religiosity and ethics and a daily life that is simply perpetuated with the structure that the unhealthy social organism has assumed. We have to learn to perceive these things accurately. Above all, seeing that the misfortunes of today spring from the gentrified distinction between the abstract and the concrete. A beginning can be made here, precisely in a movement such as ours, by creating a kind of small, healthy social organism, by endeavoring to get rid of everything unhealthy that may develop in such a movement, anything schismatic. The worst thing about this anthroposophically oriented spiritual movement has been the continually recurring tendencies here and there to become schismatic, to form closed groups and cliques. Without people even noticing, they strive for sectarianism of some kind. Anthroposophically oriented spiritual science must be the very opposite of this. Then it will also meet the unconscious and subconscious needs of our time, which are definitely not about forming new sects, but nurturing what develops from the whole human being for all human beings, and from all human beings for the whole human being. You can start by reflecting, my dear friends, on how to get beyond the inner factionalism within your own souls. Today, sectarianism lives in us atavistically, a kind of unhealthy legacy in numerous souls. And this factionalism arises from the reluctance to carry a true life of spirit into the outward conditions of life. The same cloud cuckoo factionalism gives rise to the objection to the appeal of which I spoke yesterday and which I read out to you, that it is not sufficiently spiritual and that it was expected of us of all people that it would be so. But I have never been able to speak in the expected, in quotes, spiritual terms to such spiritual enthusiasts. When the Adler-Unold ethical culture movement for moral renewal began in the 1890s in America and spread from there, I opposed it completely, since it sought to found a movement for ethics in culture based on nothing real at all and connected with nothing in actual life, except to promulgate ethical principles. Understanding of life gained by drawing on the very foundations of life is what modern humanity needs, not phrase-mongering, not ought-ism about how things should be done. And in relation to the social organism, threefolding is the fundamental thing we need to reflect on, research, ponder, incorporate into people's sensibilities so that they become as well-versed in it as the two times table. The end of Lecture 2.